Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Med Talks. My name is Dr. Sachin Patel, and I'm a junior doctor currently working in the NHS. We have recently covered the approach to abnormal calcium levels, and in keeping with electrolyte imbalances, in this podcast we're going to discuss hypernatremia, which is defined as a high plasma sodium level above 145. We will cover the presentation, common causes, signs and symptoms, key investigations, and discuss how to identify the cause of the hypernatremia, which will guide us with management. We will also cover diabetes insipidus, which is one of the rarer causes of hypernatremia, but a topic that does come up in exams quite frequently. So, how do these patients present? Well, they usually present with increased thirst, lethargy, and weakness, and in severe cases, increased confusion, muscle spasms, seizures, and even coma. So symptoms are largely neurological. What are the most common causes? Well, the first thing that should come to mind in hypernatremia is water deficit. The most common cause is dehydration and being in a fluid deplete state. I'm actually seeing this a lot on my care of the elderly ward at the moment, where we have patients who just don't drink enough and have inadequate fluid intake because they're so frail they physically can't lift a cup of water to their mouth to drink. Or they have some form of cognitive impairment, and as a result, the patients can't communicate that they're thirsty, sometimes they don't recognise they're thirsty, and sometimes they just forget to drink. So risk factors include being over the age of 65 and having some form of cognitive impairment. Other causes which we will touch on include Kohn syndrome and diabetes insipidus. Assessment of a patient with hypernatremia should include thorough medical history with particular attention to fluid losses, and also drug history, looking for use of things like lithium or diuretics. We are more worried about acute hypernatremia, as this means that there has been rapid fluid shift in between cells, whereas in chronic hypernatremia, cells have had a bit of time to adjust. We should look for signs of neurological disturbance and document a GCS, and as with all patients with a high or low sodium level, we should assess their fluid status, so that's to identify if they're hypovolemic, euvolemic or hypervolemic. Now very briefly, key findings in hypovolemia may include a prolonged capillary refill time, decreased skin turgor, which is skin that when pinched returns very slowly back to normal, low blood pressure or evidence of a postural blood pressure drop, a raised heart rate to compensate, absent JVP, low pulse volume at the brachial or carotid pulse, sunken eye appearance, dry mucous membranes or dry mouth, and the absence of any lower limb pitting edema. And again, very briefly, things to suggest hypervolemic state include a raised JVP, bibasal crackles on the lungs, which might suggest fluid overload or pulmonary edema, and the evidence of pitting edema in the lower limbs. If the patient is already in a hospital setting, then we should look at their fluid balance chart to look at their fluid input, urine output, and to hopefully give us a more accurate idea of their overall net fluid status. Moving on to investigations, we should do U's and E's to check electrolytes and renal function. If the patient has an AKI, a raised urea, and sometimes a raised chloride level, these all point to dehydration being the cause of the hypernatremia. You should also do a urinary sodium level, a paired osmolality, so that includes a urine osmolality and a plasma osmolality, and also get a glucose level. Now, I've talked a lot about fluid status, and this can help us identify the cause of the hypernatremia.
Hey guys, just a quick one. If you, like me, are iPad lovers and spend all of your productive time on your iPads making notes for exams or making notes for anything else, then I cannot recommend enough the paper-like screen protector. The number of times I've scratched my unprotected iPad screen after using different styluses or styli, but since having the paper-like screen protector, it's kept my screen extremely well shielded. Its nanodot surface technology provides a better tactile feel, increased stroke friction, and minimal light diffraction so that making art and taking notes on an iPad feels as natural as writing on paper. Made for the iPad and Apple Pencil, Paperlite delivers the unforgettable feeling of real paper into your digital workspace. To find out more about this wonderful creation, you can just head on over to their website by searching paperlike.com/medtalks, and I will leave this link in the episode description so you can have a look after you've listened to the episode. And if you are interested in purchasing a Paperlike screen protector, then please do enter the code MEDTALKS at the checkout page And again, I will leave that all in the episode description. Okay, back to the episode.
So, in hypovolemia, the body has lost a lot of water and sodium, but there's been an excessive amount of water loss compared to sodium, so sodium concentration has gone up. Urine osmolality is the single most important test. In hypovolemic states, the urine will be very concentrated, resulting in an osmolality of greater than 600 milliosmoles per kilogram. This osmolality will be far greater than the plasma osmolality. In these cases, we should look for fluid losses as the cause of the hypernatremia, so diarrhea and vomiting, and we should also consider reduced oral intake as one of the causes. If we happen to do a urinary sodium, this will be low, usually less than around 10 or less than 20, and that's because the kidney's not getting enough blood flow. It wants to hold on to the sodium it has in the hope that water will follow and stay within the blood. So the urinary sodium will be low. If the urinary sodium is more than 20, then this might suggest a renal cause for the high sodium level. How do we manage this? Well, first of all, encourage oral fluid intake, but if there is poor oral intake, we want to give 0.9% normal saline, which has a sodium concentration of around 154 millimoles a litre. Now, this might seem a little bit strange because we're giving sodium to someone who's already got a high sodium level. But there is a reason for this, and that is because we want to avoid rapid fluid shifts in and out of cells. If, for example, we gave a different intravenous fluid, such as 5% dextrose, without any sodium in it, this would cause a rapid decrease in the sodium level and put the patient at risk of something called central pontine myelinolysis, which is characterized by demyelination of the pons, and that can result in permanent neurological damage. So, as a general rule, we should only correct sodium. Our target correction rate should be no more than 10 millimoles per liter every 24 hours. Moving on to the hypervolemic causes of hypernatremia. Now, these are all very rare, and the hypernatremia is usually mild. It can sometimes be caused by Kohn syndrome, so that's primary hyperaldosteronism. This is usually caused by an adrenal adenoma that might be producing excess aldosterone. So as a result, with the high aldosterone, there is increased sodium reabsorption in the kidneys and increased potassium excretion into the urine. Water follows the sodium, causing fluid retention. We can see if there's a high plasma aldosterone to renin ratio, and if so, consider a CT scan to look for this adrenal adenoma or possible adrenal hyperplasia. The blood pressure is also likely to be elevated in Kohn syndrome. Another cause that you should just be aware of is iatrogenic sodium bicarbonate administration. Now, treatments for these include diuretics that cause salt wasting, such as thiazides. In Kohn syndrome, we give potassium-sparing diuretics such as spironolactone, and the definitive treatment is usually surgery if it's being caused by a tumour. Now, moving on to our final fluid status. So that is a euvolemic fluid status, where our fluid status is normal, but we are losing loads and loads of water, causing sodium concentration to increase. Now, we treat this with IV 5% dextrose. If our patient is peeing out loads and loads of water, this should raise our suspicion of diabetes insipidus. These patients usually pass more than 3 litres of water in a 24-hour period, and as a result, their urine osmolality is less than 300 milliosmoles per kilogram. It's really, really dilute. And compared to plasma osmolality, the plasma osmolality is higher than the urine osmolality. So what exactly is diabetes insipidus? Well, it's all to do with antidiuretic hormone, otherwise known as ADH. Now, ADH is a hormone produced by the hypothalamus and secreted by the posterior pituitary in response to increased serum osmolality. It then travels to the kidneys via the blood and acts on cells in the distal convoluted tubule and collecting ducts, which triggers aquaporin 2 channels to migrate to the apical cell membrane. This allows water to flow back into the blood via the nephron, and as a result, serum osmolality is reduced back to normal levels. So in diabetes insipidus, there is either less ADH being produced, or there is less response by the kidneys to ADH. So too little water is reabsorbed, and more water is excreted, resulting in the patient peeing out loads and loads of water. That's why symptoms include polyuria, polydipsia, along with the other symptoms of hyponatremia we've previously discussed. Again, going over the investigations, plasma osmolality will increase as blood becomes more concentrated, and urine osmolality will be low as the urine is very dilute. We can divide the causes of diabetes insipidus into two categories. So when there's a deficiency of antidiuretic hormone, we call these cranial causes. Usually there's been some form of insult to the brain, the hypothalamus, or the pituitary gland. The patient may have a craniopharyngioma, a pituitary tumour, they may have suffered some head trauma, they may have meningitis, or they may have suffered from some form of genetic cause to give them the diabetes insipidus. The most common cause, though, is idiopathic. The other category is nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, and this is where ADH is being produced, but there is a lack of response to ADH by the collecting ducts in the kidneys. Again, this could be due to genetic causes, systemic disorders such as amyloidosis, polycystic kidney disease, the use of lithium, chronic kidney disease, and hypercalcemia, which we mentioned a couple of episodes ago. To identify if the diabetes insipidus has a cranial or nephrogenic cause, we can perform something called a water deprivation test. During this test, the patient is not allowed to drink fluids for 8 hours, and afterwards, we check their urine osmolality. And depending on the results, we can give them something called desmopressin, which is synthetic ADH. And then after another 8 hours, we recheck their urine osmolality. So after being fluid deprived for 8 hours, the first urine osmolality will be less than 300 milliosmoles per kilogram, and that will confirm a diagnosis of diabetes insipidus. In cranial diabetes insipidus, there is a lack of ADH, so kidneys should still respond to the desmopressin, the synthetic ADH. As a result, the second urine osmolality will be increased. It should rise to over 600 milliosmoles per kilogram because ADH is allowing more water to be reabsorbed into the blood, so less is lost in the urine, which means the urine is more concentrated. In nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, the kidneys will still be unable to respond even to synthetic ADH, so urine osmolality, the second urine osmolality, will remain low. In terms of management for cranial causes, we might need to identify the cause or look for a cause, and for that we'll probably do an MRI to perhaps look for any tumours. In the meantime, we can give synthetic ADH in the form of desmopressin. For nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, we can use diuretics like thiazides and amiloride, or we can use high-dose desmopressin. Just remember that if diabetes insipidus is suspected, you should always involve your local endocrinology team, and medications such as desmopressin should only be initiated by a specialist. Right, that is all for now, folks. Thank you very much for listening. We covered quite a complicated topic, but hopefully you should have some idea of how hypernatremia might present, the common causes, what investigations you need to do, and how you can use these investigations to try and identify the cause and treat the cause. It is quite a lot of information, so do feel free to pause the podcast at any point, go back and re-listen to it. If you've got any questions, feel free to contact us at hellomedtalks@gmail.com. If you wish to give us any feedback, you can leave a response there. We're always love to hear your feedback so we can improve our podcast going forwards. You can contact us on Instagram at medtalks.uk, and feel free to share with your friends or anyone else who might find these podcasts useful. That is all for now, and we will catch you on the next episode. Goodbye.